I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I want to talk about the writer Octavia Butler's Dawn, book one in the Xenogenesis trilogy. I had to look at my notes because it's not normal to me to say that, but yeah. So I want to talk about book one, Dawn, of the Xenogenesis trilogy. Okay, so I don't have to tell you that it has been, well, I will say this. For me, it has been an interesting, the time I'm recording this is before my normal release day. So like just before my normal release day. So it's Wednesday. So it is 36 days. It has been a very interesting 36 days of the new year for me. I'm exhausted actually because of roles that I've taken on, changes at my job that are, I'm still trying to wrap my head around and still trying to figure out what I want to do going forward, all while planning activities and things because I still got to go to work. You know, just trying to find balance and trying to figure out my way. Do you know what I mean? And then plus you've got, I shared last episode, the coronavirus, which I did finally hear somebody else say it other than me. And I guess I'm so doggone juvenile. I was laughing or chuckling or found it weird. Why? Because there's a drink called, there's a beer called Corona. And I'm like, there's no way that I am pronouncing this virus, this flu virus, or super flu virus, whatever it is, the same way that you would pronounce the beer. Like, what? No, I have to be saying it differently. I have to be saying it wrong. No, it's coronavirus. Anyway, so I don't know that I shared, but so I work at a small nonprofit, mental health, but non-clinical nonprofit here in Baltimore. And you know how nonprofits do. You have interns. You get interns and it's like a quid pro quo. They need the hours and you need the body without paying for it. So to do the work without paying for it and all of that. So but you know, you still have to make sure it's a good fit, that they can do the work that you need them to do, that they're not going to be, they're going to be good ambassadors for your organization, and that you won't have to run behind them every time to clean up what they're doing within reason. You know what I mean? Like, you're not giving them super important reporting tasks, but you're certainly giving them things that they can do that was that would be helpful to you in furthering whatever you're doing. And we just don't have the money to be able to put staff where they should be at our organization. In my department alone, honestly, there really ought to be four or five people. There's only three. And there really should be, well, four is too many, too few. I think it's more like five or six, to be honest with you. And that's just starting out, but there's only three of us. So anyway, so that's where you get the interns. So for a short time, until mid-May, from this month until mid-May, we're going to have four-person staff doing some work. Obviously, the intern's not coming in all the time, but anyway, so we get interns all the time and they have various lengths of stay. Some they're coming in, maybe some every day, maybe a couple of times a week, right? Anyway, we have this one intern from Hopkins University, Johns Hopkins University, super smart. She's from China. And that is only relevant because of the story I'm about to tell. And you know where I'm going, coronavirus. So anyway, so super smart, because duh, she's a grad student, duh. Well, that's not always given, but she was smart and very savvy and very quick and very eager to learn new things and really carve out her own way, even though she was already trying to master, and as far as I'm concerned, did master English. She was also trying to, when she was with us, learn Spanish, not master it, because she was still trying to learn it, because she wanted to be more well-rounded. Or actually, I don't know why. I just think she was curious and she wanted to be trilingual. So, yeah, she began to do those things, and she tagged along with me. She wasn't my primary intern or an intern that was primarily assigned to me, but she was doing work that happened to, that would require us to work together. And so I got to know her, and super sweet and very friendly and just, awesome, an awesome person, very sweet and an awesome person. Well, the end of her internship was in December, and you know, we gave her a big send off, as we do, because when you got a good intern, you got to let them know that how, you know, you can't pay them, so you just show out for them by letting them know in small ways how you appreciated them. And so we had this dinner and all of that stuff, and it was really great. And so anyhow, so, you know, and just understanding her plans, she said that, oh, it had been over a year since she'd been back home to China to see her family and her grandmother and all of that. So she wanted to, for the Chinese New Year and over the school break, go home do, you know, do the Chinese New Year celebrations. But she wanted it in China because she's been in the United States for a while in undergrad. And now she's here in, like, she was in middle America doing her undergrad studies, and then she came here to Hopkins and, you know, doing her thing there. And yeah, so it had been a minute since she'd been home. And I listen, I like to get up and go. I got up and went from my family, and you know, you do get homesick. And so a year for a young person, especially someone who's she's in grad school, but she's still early 20s. And the fact that she's in a completely different continent than her family, I can imagine that a year is a long time to not see your family and really love up on them. And so she was telling us that she wanted to go home and she wanted to experience the Chinese New Year in China and all of that stuff. And we were excited. So she left. Flash forward to mid-January, and the coronavirus is just wiling out and spreading. And I began to worry. I know we all did, but none of us said it in the office. We all worried, but I began to worry because I was like, oh, shoot. Because when she left the internship, she had exchanged numbers with everybody that wanted to exchange numbers, and certainly I got her cell. And so I'm sitting up here thinking, okay, when was she supposed to be due back? Maybe everything is cool. But we hadn't heard. She wasn't answering texts. So obviously, that didn't necessarily mean that things were bad, but it just meant that she wasn't answering texts. So, and then, what was it, last week? Well, the week before last, who should be in the office but our very fabulous fall intern? Well, summer fall intern. Oh, my goodness. Oh, very healthy. Came back with a fresh new do. Okay. With a little color. Okay. She looked very refreshed and ready for battle because she's finishing, I think, her last semester of her graduate school program or her master's program. So she is ready for battle. But she looked good. Was very pleased, and she reported that her family, even her grandmother, everybody was fine. Nobody was sick. Everybody was cool. And that she made it back before they shut down the airports and they were, and the United States was being funny and being xenophobic. I mean, what else can you call it? A little bit, xenophobic. They're just xenophobic. And what did the WHO say? Like, adding stigma to those countries, making it seem like everybody from those countries has that virus, especially China, because that's where the coronavirus, I believe it originated from, China, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, so, but she's cool, her family's cool, and she's back here ready to do battle for her final semester. And I'm just grateful for that because I really was worried about her, but she's cool. The other thing that has recently happened is, again, I'm doing this the day before release, so, because I'm just late. Anyway, and yesterday was the election, and the special election for Maryland's 7th District, the spot that Elijah Cummings, who passed away in September from cancer, his seat, right? And so there were 24 candidates, and I'm not joking. When me and my hubby, we went to the polling station yesterday morning, which is conveniently located up the street, literally up the street at this middle school or elementary middle school, up the street from our house. Literally, we were only there to vote on this particular seat, and there were 24 candidates. And it was a ghost town when we went there. It was only like four or five people that had gone ahead of us, but that we saw. But I heard that people were trickling in, and it got like, you know, the late evening rush, as you do, before the polls closed and when people got off work. Anyway, so Kwesi Mfume won out of all 24 candidates. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, if just a little history, Kwesi Mfume held the 7th. That was his seat before he gave it up in the 90s to Elijah Cummings, who won it. Kwasi Nfume gave it up so that he could be the head of the NAACP, which he was for many years before he gave that up to do other things too. So, in many ways, it makes sense that a lot of people voted for them, because what we know is that old people tend to come out, and this is not ageist. It's just people who come out to vote tend to be older people, or the people who do come out as you're looking at low voter turnout. I mean, the people who come out tend to be informed. And if you're talking about Baltimore politics, we tend to vote for people that we can, voters in general tend to vote for people that they feel familiar with. And what I know is that I don't watch a lot of TV, but what people were telling me was that Kwasi Nfume was all over the TV waves. And that I know that some of my friends who were in the 7th, they received phone calls for some of the other candidates for the position or for the seat for their vote. And I'm like, I don't know what y'all signed to get on that list, but I'm just getting all the mail. You know how it is, those little pamphlets that you get talking about my candidacy. I'm the only one this, I'm the only one that. I got all of them, but nobody ever called my cell phone. Why? Because I'm very careful when I sign up for things not to put my cell phone. You can mail me anything in the world. Don't mean I'm gonna read it, but what you won't do is send me any text or call me. That's what you're not gonna do. Anyway, so I'm always very careful about where I put my phone number. And obviously a lot of my friends were not, and so they were mad, as you would be if you get an unsolicited text, especially political or otherwise. So I hope they rectify whatever they got to do to get off those call lists. But I don't think that's going to happen, because what I know from an acquaintance of mine who ran for another representative seat in another district in Baltimore City, there's this whole program that you run for if you want to be a candidate, and it teaches you the rules of the road. And long story short, you can buy these constituent lists with the right amount of money. I mean, it's not the right amount of money. It's not bribery. You literally can buy it. It's a for sale. And so if you are on these constituent lists, which all of us are, if you vote, all your information is on there, or at least all the information that you cared to give. So if you gave your cell phone, oh, well, girl, oh, well, I did not. So I just, my only counsel to my friends was, okay, well, make sure that whomever's reaching out to you, ask them to remove you from your list, that list. That's all you can do. But if somebody else, some other candidate should buy that list for later, for these council seats that are coming up in November. Oh, well, girl, you're gonna have to do the same thing and be careful going forward what you sign. Anyway, or at least what information you add. Anyway, I got sidetracked like a mug. Anyway, so yeah, the election's over. And like I said, Kwasi Nfume won by a landslide. You hear me? There were 24 candidates and he won by a landslide. Anyway, so we'll see what this turns out to be. But I guess a lot of people voted. It was like a legacy vote. You know what I mean? Like, that's how Baltimore is for the most part. We know you. We vote for you. Yes, I'm saying we, even though I've only been here for 12 years. I feel like I'm part of Baltimore now. Anyway, but that's just kind of how the old folks around me talk. That's kind of how the young folks around me talk. It's like, yeah, we know them. Like, if they're active at all. Yeah, we know them. I mean, it's whatever. Like, of course they talk about new energy, but come on, young and old. We can tell when you see through, honey. And it just is what it is. If you're a ghost, you're a ghost. So the mayoral election and all these, council seats, that'll be interesting, especially mine. Woof. Mine is going to be real interesting because I believe there are like 4 or 5 candidates for my jurisdiction for city council, because the person who had been in that seat for decades, she's like, I'm up. I'm out. I think she's at 70 plus years old at this point. She's like, I've had it. She endorsed a candidate and like everybody else coming out of the woodwork. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway. But today, there's so many other things I could talk about, but what I would rather talk about today, I'm watching The Young Pope. I will talk, or The New Pope. I will talk about that at some point because, man, I have always enjoyed, I don't even know if I've ever talked on this show, how much I enjoy the cinematography and the style of that show, but I just am so drawn to it. Anyway, so I'm watching The New Pope, and I like it. I like it a lot. And maybe I'll talk about it at some point, but I'm not talking about it right now. Today, I'm going to talk about Dawn, the book by Octavia Butler, Dawn in the Xenogenesis trilogy, book one. And you know how I do. I subscribe to Audible because duh. And so I listen to a lot of books, but I also read a lot of books. And I know there are some snobs there that say, I want the pure book. Listen, I get content however I get it. I absorb it. I love that stuff. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I read a lot of books, and I listen to a lot of books too, because it's all the same to me. It's so funny because sometimes I read a book and then I think I listen to it. And then sometimes I will listen to a book and I think I will have, I read it. Because I do them interchangeably because I'm not a snob. It doesn't matter to me. I just get it how I get it. And I can't read a book while I'm at work, but you know what I can do while I'm doing a mundane task? I can listen. So anyway, but I read this book and I just whistled through this first one. And so I want to talk about it. So if you're not a fan of Octavia Butler, you should probably think about becoming one. It's sci-fi. She's all about sci-fi, but again, she's a Black writer, and so she's speaking, Black American writer, and so she injects, I think she does it smartly. She talks about Black Afrofuturism in a way that's not gimmicky. If that's the best way I can describe it. She's one of those that does it right. Not that I have a list of people who do it wrong, but she does it right in my opinion. And so this book is an example of doing it right. And it is, this should be a movie. I don't know why it's not. This should be a movie though. And I will tell you why when I get into the meat of it. Okay, so let me get into it. So again, I'm jumping right into Dawn, the first book in Octavia Butler's Xenogenesis trilogy. And I guess a few things you should know about the book is that it came out and it was published in what, 87? Yeah, it was published in 1987. So though it was a late 80s book, I don't know, man. Well, let me back up. What I will say is that for me as a child, the 80s was an interesting time for sci-fi for me. I can remember watching a whole bunch of movies. I think I've talked about this in an episode maybe a year or two ago where I was talking about 80s movies. And anyway, there was this movie who I've already forgotten the title, but Tom Cruise was in it. And he was basically something like a Zelda type, Link type. The guy that's going after Zelda, the princess, right? Ooh, what's the name of it? Tim Curry was in it as a demon. Dang, I can't call the name of that movie. Ooh, I can't call the name of a movie, but you know what I'm talking about. So anyway, Tom Cruise was a Link sort of person. Whose character was reminiscent of Link in the Zelda series, the game. You know what I'm talking about. Google it. Anyway, it came out in the 80s as well. And I remember being enchanted with that because, of course, I watched it on VHS because I did not watch it in the theaters. My elder siblings always recorded stuff on TV. And then when I was coming up, early 90s, we didn't have cable. I don't even think cable was a thing. In the early 90s, or maybe it was, but we sure didn't have it until much later, until I was older. So anyway, I watched a lot of VHS tapes, and a lot of those VHS tapes came from the 80s, the late, middle to late 80s, right? And so this movie that I'm talking about with Tom Cruise, that was on, and I watched it a jillion times. Then there was another movie called Solar Babies. I do not know when that thing came out, but it was all futuristic and stuff, and blah, blah, blah. I really loved it, watched it a jillion times. And I talked about this. I've talked about the 80s films that I watched ad nauseum largely because, number one, my parents were not giving me money to go to the theater. Number two, I didn't want to. Number three, we didn't have cable. Number four, I didn't like hanging out with, I liked to hang out with my friends, but I didn't like to sleep over at my friends' houses. I never did. I did it, but I liked the comfort that I had for me at my home. So anyway, spent a lot of summers, summer evenings, well, many summer evenings and some weeknights during the school year watching and rewatching these VHS tapes. And so that's where I got my love for sci-fi. And then my dad worked a night shift. And so I would crawl in the bed with my mom when I was little, and she would always be reading some Stephen King book, right? Something that my mother and I share a genetic something or other, I guess. It's like, I don't know if it's just a trait that we sleep talk. We talk in our sleeps. We talk in our sleep, and mom walks in her sleep. Dead serious. She walks in her sleep. It's only when she's stressed, but nevertheless, she walks in her sleep. And my husband has told me that when I am stressed out, I talk. You can't always understand me, but I talk. And of late, I have, and this is a total aside, but I pinched him really hard in my sleep the other night, maybe a week or so ago. And what was weird is that I swore I was in a dream fighting with him because he said something stupid. And I pinched him, and he said, "You did that in real life, and I thought you stabbed me." And I laugh about it, but I'm just like, oh shoot, I hope I don't get like my mom and I start sleepwalking, because that's unnerving, because mom used to scare the crap out of me when I was a child. Me and my siblings, because she'd be like standing on top of stairs and stuff, and I'd be worried that she would fall. Anyway, but there's a point to that sidebar. The point is, I always felt like her when I was a child, I always felt like her dreams, those vivid dreams, were because of all those doggone scary sci-fi books that she would read. And now I know it's just stress, and then any stimulation, any sort of, she could have been reading about cupcakes, and she would have had nightmares about cupcakes because she was stressed and all of that stuff. But I know that now. But when I was a child, I was like, oh, you just need to read different books, those sci-fi books. But nevertheless, I still loved to read and watch sci-fi, just not the scary stuff, because again, my mom, the scary stuff made mama walk in her sleep. And so that wasn't going to be me. So anyway, I always nurtured a love for sci-fi books. And even though I love Stephen King, it's like, I love Stephen King, but all his books scared me, right? Even It scared the crap out of me. I only watched It in the daytime, and I dared not read it. Come on, dared not read it. It's only here later that I'm beginning to read more Stephen King, duh. But I'm still doing it in the daytime. Anyway, so I've always been a sci-fi fan. But I've never had the privilege of reading sci-fi that I saw myself in. All of the movies I just mentioned, the movies and the books I mentioned, It, Solar Babies, that movie with Tom Cruise that I can't remember the name of. There are actually many more sci-fi films that Alien, all the aliens. 80s sci-fi, either in, for the most part, popular books or Star Trek even didn't have to be scary. Again, I kind of avoided the scary stuff because I was a punk. I still am. And so anyway, so I got all the Star Treks, every last one of them. Any variation you can think of, I watched it, even the old ones. I would fall asleep to those, but nevertheless, I watched them. Anyway, so I've always been a sci-fi fan. And so, but I never had the chance, the privilege to read sci-fi with characters who overwhelming it lead characters that looked like me or could be a part of my family. Do you know what I mean? Not that they weren't there, because clearly I said that books like, well, shoot, this book came out in 87. It was produced in 87. So it's not like I didn't have an opportunity to read it. I didn't have access to it because my mama or none of my teachers or anybody fed that hunger inside of me. And plus, I don't think I ever articulated that I wanted to see it, but I knew that I wanted to see stories that looked like me. But I guess I didn't have the courage to ask for something like that when I was in elementary school, middle school. Although there was a couple of teachers that gave me, they wanted to give me things that of authors who had character, either authors or books with characters that looked like me in them. It's just they didn't know quite how to do that. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, I didn't know how to articulate it. And this was the same. This was true all the way through high school, when I think I've shared this before. I went to a predominantly white high school, middle school too. Anyway, and when I was in high school, I was chosen to go to this conference for kids of color by my principal.
I look back on it now and I'm like, what? But at the same time, they knew that I needed to be connected with people that looked like me. I don't know if I had said anything or not. I don't recall ever being vocal. I just remember just trying to get through high school. That's all I remember. I just remember trying to stay out of trouble, be in every after school program I could, read. Just stay out of trouble because I knew I didn't want to be there. And I figured, let me just keep my head down and get it going so that I can no longer be here. And so I just remember always getting books when the book club came around. And then somehow or another, I end up in this program where I go to this, in high school, I go to this conference, which is a bunch of black and brown kids at the conference, catering to black and brown kids at this conference. And I get even more books. To this day, I still know my old high school principal, that he's friends with my parents. Cause my parents still live in the town where, I went to, middle and high school. Anyway. But yeah, it's never a question I ask. Even my English teacher, who I'm sure was a part of me going to that conference, cause there was a literary piece to that conference too. So, my high school English teacher, AP English, all of that, I'm quite sure she had something to do with that, but I didn't ask no questions and I haven't asked those questions until this day. Anyway, but my story for the most part, I've shared that even in college, that's when I began to say, you know what? I reject watching. I don't have to watch. I don't have to subject myself to imagining what these brown characters would do in this all white ensemble, in these books, in these movies, so on and so forth. Right. I don't have to. If I want to consume majority brown cast films, entertainment, that's what I'm going to do. And I don't feel a way about it. Now, when I was in college, I think I went too far because I was still performing blackness in that I was putting on and saying and performing the way that I thought somebody who was in tune to their culture and who advocated for their culture would do. How you evolve and change with more thought and more practice and more listening to other people, but still forming your own opinion. And so I've changed, but I never lost the desire to appreciate art, appreciate more art that reflected me, or at the very least with lead characters that looked like me. And so even in college, I didn't know, I hadn't discovered Octavia Butler because, I don't know, the people I hung out with, we didn't really read sci-fi. You know, we were into biographies, right? And theory and all of that stuff, because I guess that's what you do when you go to college, right? You start reading about a whole bunch of theory and black liberation theory and Pan-Africanism and all of that. Because again, I was trying to figure out the best way to, I was performing in a way and it wasn't authentic. And so, yeah, I ran away for the most part from my sci-fi roots, largely probably because, if I'm being honest with myself, probably because I didn't think I could see a way forward there. Like I couldn't see myself there because for the most part, every sci-fi something or other that I had consumed was majority non-brown, non-people of color. Right. So in these futures, there weren't many people of color, or if they were, they were light in color. They weren't brown like me, right? And so how can you get into, like, how can you truly appreciate a genre that doesn't appreciate you? Doesn't see you in it is the real thing. Doesn't really see you in it. And so I can't remember, I don't know when I fell back into loving black sci-fi again, or at least rediscovered black sci-fi. I think it was maybe my senior year in college, when I was turned on to Black Panther. Now, keep in mind, that's sci-fi, that's Afrofuturism. But I didn't, you know, I just dabbled. Anyway, flash forward to now, I'm all about, you know, absorbing this content and really getting it in my spirit. And I've tried to read Octavia Butler, and I got to be honest with you, I started a couple of her books. What was it? I think I read what I thought I was supposed to be reading, like Parable of the Sower, is that her? I can't call it. Anyway, but I tried to read some of those books that were by black sci-fi books that were about black authors, or by Black authors. It's just nothing struck my fancy. And I think I did start an Octavia Butler book, but I gave it back because it just didn't strike me. And so I get this, I buy a Amazon, what is it? What the heck did I buy? A Kindle? No, it wasn't a Kindle. Amazon Fire. I just be buying stuff. I don't even know what I bought. Anyway, I bought an Amazon Fire ahead of a conference I was going to because I was tired of trying to write everything down on my notebook because I didn't want to write it on a notebook. I wanted a tablet, but I didn't want to go out and buy a full-blown computer because I already have two laptops at the house, right? One work, one personal, right? So I didn't want to buy another laptop. So I was like, oh, let me get this little Fire. I'll be all right. And use the notes app for taking notes. And so that's what I did. And so anyway, I bought that. And in buying it, because I already have an Amazon Prime account and all of that stuff, I was given access to a certain amount of free books, right? And so I pick out my first couple of books. And one of the books that I pick out is Octavia Butler's Dawn in the Xenogenesis trilogy. And anyway, I am hooked in the very beginning. I'm hooked. Not only is it a Black woman character, but after a while, it no longer matters. And I'll tell you why. This book came out in 87, so I'm spoiling it, but it's cool. You should still read it and read Octavia Butler because I'm going to read more of her. But long story short, the premise of the book is not one that it's not foreign to us in today, right? 2020. But it was an interesting concept in the 80s. Certainly it was something, I don't know how long it took Octavia to write this, Miss Butler, Octavia, I'll call her Octavia, her pronoun. I don't know Octavia's pronouns. Anyway, I'm quite sure Octavia wrote this having the knowledge of, no, not having the knowledge. She literally references the two superpowers at the time finally ending the whole world. And the two superpowers in the 80s were whom, especially who were warring against each other, were whom? Russia and the United States, for the most part. And a lot of that was bluster. But at the end of the day, that's who she chose to be the catalyst for ending the world. And so the book starts, book one, Dawn. Again, that's the only one I've read in the trilogy so far, but book one begins with an end, which is the end of the world, right? There's this huge, I guess, for lack of a better term, both the United States and Russia used their nukes and blew up the world, basically. And these aliens, who are called the Onkali, and I know I'm about to butcher a bunch, just go with it. Come and save the remaining, the survivors of the car that left in the wreckage of the world blowing up. So let me go ahead and just read the synopsis and then I'll get into it. So Lilith Iapo has just lost her husband and son when atomic fire consumes Earth, the last stage of the planet's final war. Hundreds of years later, Lilith awakes deep in the hold of a massive alien spacecraft piloted by the Onkali, who arrived just in time to save humanity from extinction. They have kept Lilith and other survivors asleep for centuries as they learned whatever they could about Earth. Now it is time for Lilith to lead them back to her homeworld. But life among the Onkali on the newly resettled, apparently I can't read today. But life among the Onkali on the newly resettled planet will be nothing like it was before. The Onkali survived by genetically merging with primitive civilizations, whether their new hosts like it or not. For the first time since the nuclear holocaust, Earth will be inhabited. Grass will grow, animals will run, and people will learn to survive the planet's untamed wilderness. But their children will not be human. Not exactly. So that's the book in a nutshell. And how you get from point A to point B is the interesting part. And Octavia does what Octavia had to do. Octavia did what had to be done in the writing of this. It's very well written. And so the lead character is a Black woman, but that is not central to the story. It's a fact. Okay. Next. It's a fact like the world was blown up by Russia and the United States. Okay. Fact. Okay. Let's move on. But the interesting part comes when, so the technology that these aliens use, again, for the 80s, I know this would have blown readers' mind, because it's certainly in the decades since this thing has been written, we are still talking about levitation. You know what I mean? We're still, like, I think one of the few movies, we're talking about levitation, we're talking about the possibility of aliens, but for the most part, aliens that we imagine still look like us, right? And I think this story, even 20 years later, 80, 90, 10, 20, okay, I started to count, is still new and fresh in that, again, most of what we read, most of what we watch has any alien or extraterrestrial life form looking like us. That's not what Octavia does. Octavia has the alien look like an alien, and the description of this thing makes it look gross, and then allows the lead character, Lilith, to react how you would to something that looked like a daggone centipede. You know what I mean? With tentacles. Gross, right? But still understood how to talk to you, could learn to talk to you, right? So you have that push and pull, but then you also have this interesting idea of the way they use and recycle waste, basically, and converting it into energy. So there's some interesting concepts about how to use waste in a different way, which I think that was a conversation back in the 80s. If you remember, what was it with Michael J. Fox? Back to the Future. So remember in the DeLorean, the thing that got the DeLorean to go was trash. If you put trash, alcohol or whatever, if you put trash in that car, that car got up to 88 miles an hour and then could break the plane to be able to go to another dimension, right? And so, yeah, I think that was a concept that was floating around. But the way Octavia uses it in this novel is takes it to a next level. So you don't just convert trash into energy or fuel. You turn it into creating this whole system to be able to reproduce food again. All sorts of energy, not just energy to go, but energy to live, right? To power this spaceship, which Lilith awakens to find herself on. Anyway, so I'll just share that, you know, Lilith is a well-rounded character in that she goes through the grieving process of having lost her husband and son, even though her husband and son weren't lost to the nuclear holocaust. They were lost before that, but she was still trying to grieve that, and then the world ended, right? So she's trying to unpack the fact that not only is she alone, but she's no longer on Earth anymore. And now I'm in the face of these aliens, these extraterrestrial creatures, beings that are gross looking, and clearly they have a plan, and I would simply not like to be a part of it. But nevertheless, she is the key to that thing, because what is the old adage? The person that least wants to be the leader is the most likely leader, because they understand the weight that is leadership, the weight that comes with leadership, right? And so there's that push and pull. And what happens, there is an element of what you would expect to happen. She's not the only human who has been saved. And it is her goal to, as the synopsis said, they're going to go back to Earth, right? And they're going to, with the Uncali, repopulate the Earth. Only the kids of these saved humans won't be human, so human, right? There'll be a blend of the Uncali and humans. And so anyway, but to get to point A, from there to point B, which is back on Earth again, they use Lilith to basically lead the way and wake up these humans. And you can imagine there's a lot of push and pull that comes with waking up these humans. There's a whole lot of conflict that comes along with believing that they're actually on a ship, that believing that Lilith, because of something that the Uncali did to her to make her more, they didn't make her more like them, but they did enhance her natural abilities in a way that make her appear to be alien to these humans that she's now waking up. So there's some conflict there. And then there's also this interesting story that it reminds me of starting over. And so, it is starting over in Civilization, and they bring them back to this primitive, this primitive state where they have to, before they are left, before they are put back on Earth, they have to learn how to fend for themselves in a simulated environment that reminds them of the Earth, right? And in doing that, like, there's just a lot of things that happen. There's conflict that comes up because, again, people still don't trust. The Unkali trust Lilith, but these humans that she's woken up. She's woken up at this point, 40 humans to help be among the first to repopulate the planet. They don't trust her. Many of them don't trust her. And so things come about that happens that tend to come about when you are left in the care of someone who you don't quite trust. Right. So violence happens. And yeah, I think there's a lot of, this story is still fresh to me, even though it was published in 87. I can't think of a single American film that treats the end of the world and the beginning of it again in this way. And it's been over 20 years, right? I think the closest that we could possibly get to this. Actually, I can't think of anything. I can't honestly, any of the sci-fi films that I can think of that have to do with repopulating the planet all have to do with partial destruction of the planet, not total destruction, right? Where everybody's wiped off the face of the Earth or the survivors. Oh, excuse me. I keep yawning and I apologize. The survivors, I can't think of an instance in American film anywhere where the survivors are taken from the planet and the entire planet is regenerated with the help of alien technology, which means that the Earth is not totally the Earth anymore. It's Earth 2.0, right? And then you're going to repopulate that thing. I can't think of a single story, sci-fi story, that mimics that. And I just think because that still doesn't exist, it's well over 20 years later that I think that this thing should be a movie. And forgive me if this has been turned into a film that I just don't know about, because, again, it's only recently that I've been actively discovering Afrofuturistic films. Like, I did the digging in music, and I love Sun Ra and everybody that's like Sun Ra, or people who are not like Sun Ra but they're still Afrofuturistic. I'm doing the work in movies. Even Sun Ra has movies. But I'm doing the work in movies, and now I want to do it in books. And I don't, if there is a concept that already exists and is on film, I want to know about it. I want to see that thing. Because, again, even I can't think it, all of the movies that I can think of. It was it Station 9. What was the one that was based in South Africa where the aliens came to the United States? The aliens came to, it was based in South Africa. There's an alien ship crash landed, and then a bunch of aliens started to assimilate into the culture there. And this one particular worker gets infected and becomes one of them. And then it's this big old thing, right? I cannot remember the name of the film, but like, that's close, but it's still no cigar, because it talks about humans breeding with, mating with, and having children with aliens, but not quite. You know what I mean? I can't think of anything that really comes close. And again, that's a South African film. I have no idea what the Asian diaspora has come up with, and I know they've got some great concepts out there. But again, I can't tell of someone or something that has come close to this story. And so I just want to see it in film, because I just know that if you get the right director, that this thing will really be a something to see, a sight to see. Because again, even though it was written in 87, the concept to me is still fresh. Everything I'm thinking of Westworld, but that's not aliens. That's robot. That's robotics. And AI technology. It's not the same. And that's still not changing the world so much as it's technology infiltrating the society, right? I can't think of anything that has approached this topic the way that Octavia did it. And I'm quite sure, based on how the book ended and I was able to, because of the way it was set up, to be able to read the first couple of chapters of the next book in the series. And the way that Octavia has continued to write this thing, it's like building it out, and it's a whole thing. Now, again, I think this book is different. I think it's worth your time. I think it is also worth the time of someone to produce a film about it, doing it justice, if it doesn't already exist. And again, I don't think it exists. So I just wanted to come in. I wanted to talk about that because I am wholly excited when I read or consume a piece of art that marries both my love for sci-fi as well as my love for the diaspora. And again, Lilith is a Black woman, but that is not central to the story, which I'm okay with. I just, again, my thing is the storytelling. I enjoy seeing Black characters, characters of color, brown, whatever diaspora you're a part of. But at the end of the day, I don't want that to be a gimmick either. And this doesn't feel gimmicky to me. It feels real. It feels as real as Alien and Sigourney Weaver being whatever her character's name was, right? She's just a character. She's just a character, and she's going through this thing, and you want to root for her. That's the way I feel about Lilith. Like, you understand her frustration. You understand that she wants to get away from these alien beings just as quick as she can. But at the same time, you also understand why she grows an affinity for a few of them, especially those that have become close to her, right? It's just very well written. And it's a really quick read, too. I think I read it in, 3 days? And that was in between spare time, only because it was just a fast read. I don't think it's a short book. I just think it's a fast read. Let me know if something like this exists. Point me to it, please. Leave me a message. Go to the show notes and click on that link to leave me a message to talk about it. Or if you read the entire trilogy and without spoilers, let me know what you thought about Octavia's reading, and then just writing in that series. And then generally what you think of Octavia and the books her books. If you like Octavia's books, let me know. And point me in the right direction to another one, because now I don't know where to go. Like, after I finish this series, which if book one was any indication, I'm probably going to finish it within the next week. Let me know if there's another series that I should be reading by her, or another book I should be reading. Because again, I had started to read, I think it was Parable of the Sower, but I just wasn't, maybe I wasn't in the headspace to read it, and it didn't really grab me at first. So I was just done. Whereas Dawn grabbed me from right away because of the story it was telling. And again, it began with an ending, which is what I love. I love stories that begin with an ending and a new beginning. Yep, I love that. So anyway, I'm eager to hear from you. And while you're at my page, if you feel like leaving a donation, even 99 cents is a helpful contribution. But if donating isn't your thing, as I always say, just share this episode or any episode that you think someone would resonate with or respond to well, send that to them as well. And while you're listening, thank you for listening from all of the places that you listen to: CastBox, Pocket Cast, Player FM, Spotify, Anchor.fm, of course, Apple Podcast, any of the places that you watch this thing or you listen to this thing. I really appreciate you doing so. And leave me a favorable rating. I love those. I love that. I don't have many ratings at all. At least that I can see, unless I'm not looking in the right places. But yeah, leave me a rating. 5 stars if you want to leave a rating. But if you don't think it's 5 stars, then don't leave me a rating. Because at the end of the day, what I understand is that ratings and how many people listen to this thing is how people get to know about the show. And again, this is very much a hobby for me, but I would very much like to continue doing this thing. So just share and share alike when you have a moment. All right. I appreciate you. Like I said, I think next week, I think I'll talk about the new Pope. So please be caught up. Please catch yourself up, because I'm definitely going to talk about it. Okay. All right. Until next time. Thanks for listening.